This is our VA reading group picking up or continuing our reading of cybernetics and the origin of information, picking up from page 67. So we're in chapter two. The title of the chapter is The Space of Behavior and Archaeological Space. So we're looking at this, his sort of like argument that he's going through in this chapter has to do with this idea that you have to sort of supplement the kinds of models that are used in cybernetics and gestalt psychology with a kind of axiological orientation, so an orientation towards values. So if you're trying to explain behavior, he gives the example of some of these gestalt psychologists who describe the sort of patterns in animal and human behavior in terms of like a field of actions. So you have like your action that is directed towards the fridge. You want to get something out of the fridge, and you have this sort of field where there's a kind of like tension gradient within the field. So your movement towards the fridge reduces the tension in this behavioral field or this like dynamic field of potentials. Rieu like thinks of this as like a positive development. This is like a better way of understanding behavior than like this sort of reflex type theories that we talked about in the Merleau-Ponty book, this sort of dynamic, you know, adjustment and flexibility is characteristic of all kinds of animal behavior. But he thinks it doesn't go far enough because it's still sort of relying on something that this dynamic field is something that like currently exists in space and time. A sort of behavioral space and time rather than like physical space and time, it's still something that the organism is responding to in its sort of present relation to the environment. So like I, you know, going towards the fridge am responding to this behavioral field that is like surrounding me at this moment. And what he thinks we need to do to sort of get beyond this or like what he thinks we need to sort of supplement this with is a kind of directedness in what he's describing here as this axiological space. So in terms of values. So for example, this action of heading towards the fridge that I engage in is not something that I am sort of compelled to do just by this behavioral field, this, you know, tension reduction process. My action of going towards the fridge will be affected by my own state, like whether I'm hungry or not, for example. And even if I am hungry, I could decide, you know, I don't want to go towards the fridge. I'm fasting or I am on a diet or whatever. I'm not going to get something from the fridge. So you have like not just this sort of automatic minimization of tension, you know, where you sort of descend the gradient of tension and go to the fridge no matter what, but you have some sort of orientation toward a value. So you could be oriented towards the value of not being hungry, and then you would go to the fridge, but you could also be oriented to a different value that would, you know, prevent you from going toward the fridge. And so this orientation towards the value is prior to this sort of tension reduction or this like behavioral field explanation. So you can't sort of assume that the organism is just going to be minimizing tension in some sort of behavioral fields at all times. You have to first like figure out what the organism is directed towards, what value the organism is realizing, and then you can determine what the behavioral field of that organism will be. So this is sort of like the general argument of this chapter, is that we need to move beyond this, even this dynamic behavioral field, which is like not exactly a physical environment of an organism, that it's something, you know, a little bit more mysterious, but we have to move even beyond that to this axiological space, which is even less similar or even less related to the physical spatio-temporal environment of the organism. So like these values or, you know, this axiological space is not something that is actual. It's not something like you can't sort of study the layout of the person's environment and determine whether they're going to, you know, be oriented towards getting something from the fridge or not, but it's this connection to this axiological space or this value orientation of the person is what determines, you know, whether which kind of behavioral field that person will be susceptible to following. And this is kind of characteristic of his writing in general, that we have these like sort of criticisms of like a maybe reductionist kind of psychology, you know, this sort of, even in the case of Gestalt psychology, that is, you know, itself critical of these, of like reflex theories. He's criticizing this account of like the dynamic field behavioral orientation. So he has these sort of detailed and often, I think, very cogent criticisms of specific, you know, psychological theories. And then we get these sort of like side remarks where like, oh, actually, embryos are also directed towards values, and, you know, electrons also have an inner life and so on, like just sort of thrown in. He doesn't really develop them in much detail in this book, but, you know, there are other books that where he goes into this, you know, more. But sort of the background of all this is that, like, this is kind of like panpsychist vitalism background that is like, So like, it's not just that the animal as it exists, as this, you know, organism that is like actually present in a certain space-time location that, you know, is oriented towards a value, but the formation of that organism, you know, from the embryo to this, you know, system of differentiated cells and organs and so on, this development is itself governed by a kind of axiological space and orientation towards values. That's just sort of like a background in this book. He doesn't really go into it in that much detail. Okay, so we can pick up from the heading axiological relief on page 67, if someone would like to read from there.
I can read. Axiological relief. In most actions and perceptions, guiding values that are more or less embodied in psychological themes and meanings transcending space, that are more or less embodied in quote-unquote knowledge and linked to the here and now, underlie the dynamism that Levin believes to be representable in the single plane of the actual. If I see from afar a child playing without supervision at the edge of a high cliff, the more dangerously close he comes to the edge, the more intense the impulse I feel to rush in and hold him back. If there is a guardrail, I don't feel any such impulse, as long as I know it is secure. The dynamic effect of the cliff edge and the inhibiting effect of the image of the guardrail on my reactions are obviously unintelligible if one disregards the meaningful, quote-unquote, knowledge that transfigures their image. These meanings and values do not alter the equilibrium of the elements of current perception in the way that mechanical memories alter mechanical feedbacks when the automaton's program controls their activation, or the way the attraction of a celestial body is combined with the attraction of other bodies. These meanings and values are a sort of permanent presence behind the spatiotemporal scene, giving it, as a result, a kind of axiological relief, analogous to the impression of depth produced by the combination of two images in stereoscopic vision. This quote-unquote axiological relief manifests the psychological effect of the hypergeometric dimension. It concerns, quote, the important, unquote, or quote, the valuable, unquote, in the same way that ordinary relief concerns depth. It is manifested by organized feelings or emotions, by an impression of, quote, intensity of importance, unquote, in the same way that ordinary relief is manifested by an impression of stepped distance. It may give us a feeling of emotional vertigo, similar to the vertigo experienced with depth, when there's a sudden drop in the depth of the important or the valuable, and when we feel that a slight difference in our spatiotemporal behavior will lead to a vital difference in our axiological equilibrium. On the edge of a cliff, a single step in the horizontal direction can result in a deadly vertical fall. Similarly, sometimes a single word, a single gesture can either lose or save us in the quote-unquote dimension of meanings and values. Let's take an example from Stendhal that is discussed by Levin. Julien has decided to marry Madame de Renal. However, Mademoiselle de Renal, I forget which one is which, actually. However, when the time has come for him to leave, he does not yet have the courage to carry out his plan. At a quarter to 10, in an anguish that almost makes him lose his mind, he says to himself, quote, "When the clock strikes 10, I'll do as I've decided, or else I'll blow my brains out," unquote. This example seems to illustrate that a future event can have a powerful influence on behavior. Levin, however, contests this, asking, is it really the future? If a child is trying to catch a toy that is visible but hard to reach, the goal is certainly psychologically present. It is obvious that for Julien, the goal, quote, to marry Mademoiselle de Renal, unquote, is likewise part of his present, quote unquote, life space. It is only the object content of the present psychological goal that is in the future as a physical or social fact. The present psychological reality of feelings such as fear, hope, and doubt does not depend on whether the object content of such feelings exists in a physical or social sense. These observations are indisputable, but what for Julien is quote unquote behind the present situation, troubling him to the point of anguish and madness, is not the future. It is a meaningful ideal. Julien's resolution is related to his ideal of life. It has meaning only through him. The hero's mental vertigo is a case, if ever there was one, of vertigo in the face of an, quote, axiological relief, unquote. With a small move, he is either lost or saved, just like that child on the cliff. The quote-unquote life space is only what it is because of the quote-unquote life ideal that envelops it. Marrying Mademoiselle de Renal is in itself, as an image in Julien's consciousness, neither attractive nor repulsive. It is attractive only because marrying her has the meaning for Julien of a, quote, heroic conquest, unquote. It is repulsive only because it has the meaning of an, quote, inappropriate and dangerous act, unquote. The anguishing ambivalence of the projected action is conceivable only because of its connection with two antagonistic meanings at differing distances in the axiological space, each giving rise separately to a particular axiological dynamism. The fact of ambivalence alone can be a decisive objection to quote-unquote flat geometric schemas in psychology. In the life space, we will admit, the future does not really intervene, and everything is quote-unquote actual, that is, present. But the present is dynamic only because it is in tension with a guiding ideal that is transactual. Julien's resolution, quote, to marry Mademoiselle de Renal at 10 o'clock, unquote, is only a projection in space and time of this ideal among thousands of others possible. The properties of the projection can only be explained by the properties of total reality, in the same way that the shadows in a flat drawing of a sphere only make sense because the real sphere is actually three-dimensional. So I understand that this, you know, the point that he's making about how behavioral space or life space doesn't make any sense unless we assume that it's value-laden, and that these values are not in space. You know, it's not like the value itself is something that Julien can see in his room as he's deliberating over this decision. I'm wondering if maybe I just don't know Levin's position well enough. Levin is saying that behavioral space can be understood exclusively in terms of, like, basically attractive and repulsive forces between objects in like a kind of perceptual space, which would be ridiculous. But I don't know. I wonder if Levin would say that, you know, like, why can't this axiological relief be incorporated into the understanding of behavioral space, especially if, you know, if we're admitting that it has its action on the present, even, you know, or its action is only kind of known through the present, even if it's kind of, I guess, constant over time, or like the value itself is not, strictly speaking, present.
Yeah, I also don't know Leighton's work firsthand, so I can only sort of rely on what Huye is presenting here, and then I think also Timo Don talks about Levin's work. So like I guess another sort of viewpoint on his work from that something I'm familiar with. But yeah, anyway, so I don't know him firsthand. I think the idea here is that Levin takes this story from Stendhal as like a sort of problem case for his theory, right? Where you could say that you know, this sort of behavioral field explanation is effective at sort of describing behavior in response to something that is actually present now, that is in my sort of perceptual environment, or even, you know, maybe an extended sort of perceptual environment. So I might not be, you know, I might not be able to see my fridge right now from where I am in my apartment, but you know, if I just sort of go into the next room, then I can see my fridge. And so you can sort of have this like extended perceptual environment where, like, you know, there's a sort of perceptual path between me and the fridge. But so even if you sort of grant this like extended perceptual field or this like extended behavioral field that, you know, allows for, you know, a path from where I am now to this like perception of the goal of the behavior, you could still say that something like this, you know, this action of, you know, marrying this woman is like so sort of non-concrete or non-perceptual that you can't explain it in terms of this kind of, you know, orientation in relation to this behavioral field. And then Levin, it seems like, I mean, based on Huye's presentation, it seems like Levin wants to sort of assimilate this kind of case to the case of, you know, being directed towards the fridge, based on this idea that it's not, of course, the future, you know, this possible future event of marrying Madame de Rênal, Mademoiselle de Rênal, that is sort of acting on Julien. It's not this like sort of abstract future possibility that is acting on him. It's rather something present now. It's like some sort of, you know, extended behavioral field in which this possibility of marrying her is present that is acting on him. Like, yeah, the future doesn't exist yet, so it can't actually be acting on him, essentially, is like the presupposition here. And Huye sort of accepts this in a sense. Of course, yeah, this like future event is not acting on him in a causal sense in any way. But at the same time, he wants to push back on this idea that something that is present has to be sort of operating on him instead. So like he talks about, so the idea that one way of explaining this kind of orientation towards this, you know, potential future event would be to say that it's not this, it's not the future event as such, this, you know, situation that doesn't exist yet that is acting on him, but rather his representation of this event is acting on his sort of behavioral repertoire or his like the behavioral field in which he's living. So he would have, say, like a little mental image of himself asking Mademoiselle de Rênal to marry him. And this sort of image is what is like acting on that behavioral field. But what Huye is sort of insisting on here is that this image as such doesn't have any causal force. Like, I mean, you could put like a little TV in his head that is displaying a scene where he asks Mademoiselle de Rênal to marry him, but that doesn't in itself make him do anything or you know, have any effect on his behavioral field. It's only because he has some orientation to a value, like what Huye described it as here is this heroic conquest value, that like if he marries her, then he has, you know, performed this heroic conquest. It's only because he has this orientation that this little TV in his head, this little image in his head, has an effect on his behavior. And then you could, I mean, the little TV image is, of course, a very sort of crude representation, but you could think of it as, like, you know, a proposition that he has, like, you know, he's like has an inner voice telling him, you know, I should marry Mademoiselle de Rênal. Or, you know, it could be some sort of abstract semantic representation or whatever, but whatever it is, whatever sort of a current actual content that is in the mind of Julien can only have this sort of effect on his behavior insofar as he has an orientation of some kind towards a value that is connected to that representation. So because he is oriented to this value, heroic conquest, that only because of that does this image or this, you know, semantic representation, whatever it is, of, you know, this goal of marrying Mademoiselle de Reynal actually have any effect on his behavioral repertoire or his, you know, behavioral field. And so this is what he means by this kind of, you know, shadow or projection or all these different images that he uses here. So like, or relief, like a sort of depth in the behavioral field. So if we eliminate the like effect of these values on the behavioral field, then we're still left with like two things sort of outside each other. You have the organism and this behavioral field, and then it's not, there's no reason why the organism should have any connection to the behavioral fields, or like why the layout of this behavioral field should bring about a certain behavior of the organism and not a different behavior. And so this is sort of like connected to what I was saying earlier about how, you know, your sort of directedness toward the fridge can't be explained purely in terms of just like a reduction of tension in the behavioral field, because you could, rather than, you know, wanting to satisfy your hunger, you could be have like, you know, a goal of increasing your hunger. You could be like, I don't know, giving yourself some kind of training in resisting temptation or something, and you actually want to experience hunger and not allow yourself to satisfy your hunger. So it's only once you have that orientation towards a value of some kind that there can even be a field that has these like this relief in it, this like direction of reduction of tension. Otherwise, you just have like this sort of flat, what he describes as a flat field, where like nothing would have any attractive or repulsive efficacy if the organism was not oriented towards a value in the first place that would, you know, in relation to which something would be attractive or repulsive. Yeah, and so like more generally, like some of the Gestalt psychologists that talk about this like behavioral field concept, they seem to have a kind of an ambiguous or like a difficult way of like understanding what the relationship is between this behavioral field and the sort of physically measurable environment surrounding the organism. And so like say you're looking at a rabbit and its behavior, you have, you know, for the rabbit, there's like a behavioral field involving, I don't know, grass to eat, bushes to hide in, potential predators that might be hidden in a bush, and so on. So the behavioral field involves like all kinds of potential actions and, you know, elements of the environment that are either attractive, like the grass to eat, or repulsive, like the bush that might be hiding a predator. But then, like the physical environment that you can measure with instruments and so on doesn't have any, you know, attractive or repulsive forces of that kind in it. You know, of course, there's like some like minuscule gravitational attraction of the blade of grass on the rabbit, but this is nowhere near sufficient to like draw the rabbit towards it. And so this sort of attractive force is not something you can like measure with an instrument that would sort of, you know, draw the rabbit towards it. But at the same time, they don't want to say that like the behavioral field is something like in the head of the rabbit, because they want to be able to say that the rabbit is in the behavioral field rather than the other way around. So it's like the behavioral field is something external to the rabbit. It's where the rabbit lives. It's like the world of the rabbit. But at the same time, it's not identical to the, you know, physically measurable objective environment of the rabbit, because there's no, you know, attractive or repulsive forces, you know, that that exist in that physical environment that the rabbit would be affected by. So it's not clear like where exactly we're supposed to situate this behavioral field. You know, if we think of it as you know, supposed to be realized in the physical environment, or this interaction between the rabbit and its surrounding physical environment, but not be sort of either within the head of the rabbit or identical with the physical environment. It's somehow in between the two. How exactly we're supposed to understand that like betweenness is not is not obvious from the Gestalt psychology sort of presentations of this relationship. And so Rui is kind of just like biting the bullet and saying there really is this like distinct non-spatial axiological quasi-space that sort of endows the environment with these tensions and attractive and repulsive dynamics and so on. We you have to sort of push the Gestalt psychology conception beyond this like ambiguous sort of between position of like not in the head of the rabbit, but also not identical to the physical environment. You have to just like say, there really is something non-physical that is that the rabbit is responding to, and this is where the behavioral field sort of arises from.
Yeah, that makes a lot more sense to me now. And as you were talking about in the recap, it seems like Rouillet's position is that we have to, in order to understand an organism's behavior, you have to understand the value, which gives rise to the objects as they are for the organism in the behavioral field. So in this example, considered independently of the of Julien's intense ambivalent valuation of the prospect of this marriage, it's not clear why he would be thinking about it at all. I mean, there are all kinds of present, past, and future events that may be occupying his behavioral field, and this particular possible event is only taking up so much of it because of the intense ambivalent valuation he attaches to it, or that it has for him.
Yeah, I think that's a slightly different point, but it's also a good one. Maybe to distinguish what I was saying earlier, and then how you presented it. What I was describing earlier is that even if you suppose that there is an occurrent sort of presentation of this potential future marriage to the mind of Julien, that he has this, like I was saying, this TV, display in his head that is depicting this potential marriage, or he like is sort of saying to himself in his head, I'm going to marry Mademoiselle de Reynal, whatever sort of occurrent phenomenon that is sort of presenting this potential future event in the present. Even if you suppose that this is the case, you still haven't like explained why this, occurrent presentation of the potential future event should have any impact on his behavioral field, or the behavioral field that he's responding to. Like, why does the fact that he has this little image in his head affect anything else going on in his behavioral environment? But then the second point that I think you were presenting is also important, is that in that previous point, you're already sort of presupposing that he does have this relationship to the potential future event, by means of this, image in his head, or, sentence that he's saying to himself or whatever. There's no explanation of why this particular potential future event would be the one that he's entertaining in his mind, or that he's, presenting to himself, as opposed to the, infinitely many other potential events. Like, why is he not thinking about the eventual heat death of the universe, or whether humans will be replaced by a race of ant overlords, or whatever other potential future event that you could imagine? Why is this specific one the one that is sort of presented in his mind at the moment? So again, here for Rouillet, we have to understand this in terms of the value orientation of Julien, that he's related to this value of heroic conquest in axiological space. And then sort of descending from that, we get the fact that he will pick out this potential future event of marrying Mademoiselle de Reynal as the one that he's going to, sort of entertain, that he's going to present to himself. And secondarily, once he has sort of depicted this potential future event to himself, that depiction will have a sort of efficacy on his behavioral field in such a way as to make him either do something or, he has this sort of ambivalent relationship to it here, so maybe he won't do anything, but it has an effect on his behavior rather than just being, you know, sort of this static image that happens to be in his mind. So that's kind of like the two stages here of like descending from this value to like producing the sort of self-presentation of a future event in the first place. And then secondly, for that self-presentation to have some sort of efficacy on his behavioral field. And so for Ruyer, we can't understand either of those elements without sort of starting from the orientation toward a value. Okay. Yeah, so we can go on to the next bit. If someone can read from Undetermined Ideals on page 69, please.
Yeah, I can read. Undetermined Ideals. In the absence of the axiological dimension, it is difficult to understand how it is that most of our goals can be undetermined. We do not see at all how it is possible to include these undetermined goals in a topological, open quote, space of behavior, end quotes, or in the schema of an exclusively nervous feedback. This difficulty is not solved by pointing to the distinction between the indetermination of the content of the ideal goal and the concrete determination of the psychological fact itself. Let us take the case of an artist or an inventor, haunted to the point of anguish by an aesthetic or scientific ideal that he foresees but is unable to achieve. One may say that, as a psychological fact, this tension or anguish is nonetheless perfectly determined, and this is enough to safeguard the principle of concreteness. But this is merely a play on words. No one denies that the embryo, in each of the phases of its development, is something concrete and well-determined. But this quote-unquote concrete is nonetheless abstract and undetermined compared to the adult stage or to a more advanced phase of differentiation. It is exactly the same in the case of the artist or the inventor. His hunches are specific psychological facts. They are what they are. But one must add at once, they are what they are only because they are heading towards an ideal that has not yet been realized. This hypergeometric transitivity, or if one wants, hyperconcrete transitivity, part of the very being and alone explains their dynamic dynamic character. It is not the presentiment of the goal, it is the goal of which there is a presentiment, which attracts the artist. On a vectorial schema of the space of behavior, it is not the presentiment that it is necessary to represent. It is the ideal aim, and an ideal aim must be symbolically represented on a dimension that is, quote-unquote, vertical to spatiotemporal dimensions, and is of an order entirely different to them. If we want to respect the principle of concreteness by representing only the presentiment, it is no longer dynamic. If we want to respect the dynamism, it is necessary to abandon the principle of concreteness by representing the goal outside the field of the actual. We know that Jean-Antoine Watteau created the composition of the embarkation for Cythera slowly and progressively. He refined his, quote-unquote, arabesque over a long period of time. If he had died more prematurely, without having time to realize his work, the final arabesque of this picture, such as we have it, would not have had any place in our world. And yet it would have acted on our world as an invisible center of attraction behind the painter's various drafts. At no time would it have been, quote-unquote, the future, relative to the present, l'actuel, since, by hypothesis, it would never have been realized. This is proof that the temporal dimension past, and then there's an arrow to the future, is only an inadequate projection, in such a case, of the hyperdimension ideal to the actual, or ideal than an arrow to the actual. An artist is struck by a subject, which will become a work, Upre, if God gives it life, only because it awakens in him a still vague but dynamic ideal. Mathematicians who, before Lobachevsky, tried to prove the postulate of parallels, were guided by an ideal that was determined only roughly, open quotes, to find an unassailable demonstration, end quotes. Moreover, under the circumstances, this roughly expressed ideal was not the authentic ideal, which was, open quotes, non-Euclidean geometry, end quotes. Far from being able to be schematized, the ideal only had a deceptive effect in the researcher's psychological reality. And yet, it is this kind of an observable ideal that governs the lives of countless artists or inventors. It is a moral or social ideal that is unobservable or hidden under utopian disguise. that drives the lives of countless activists and keeps them fighting against all odds. Winds and tides, that is, actual forces or obstacles, can be represented without difficulty in the space of behavior, but the ideal that counterbalances them cannot, because it cannot be located anywhere, without, however, being a utopian nowhere with caps in the end.
Yeah, we can probably stop here. There's about a page more in this section. So the example of like the artist, to go back a step here. So of course the what he's presenting here is the fact that these ideals are not necessarily sort of presented in full determinacy and probably are never, I think, represented in full determinacy. So like if you are picturing your goal as an artist or a mathematician or whatever, if you had like a full picture with all the details worked out of your goal before you started, then you would kind of already have solved the problem like before you even start working on it, right? It does seem that like there, like you can think of like maybe Mozart or someone who like seems to have had this capacity to sort of depict a whole symphony sort of in all its details, like in one sort of initial thought, and then just had to write it down. So maybe it is the case that some artists or other sort of creative people are able to do this kind of like translation in this sort of direct way. But like mostly, if you think of someone writing a novel or doing a painting or whatever it is, they have some sort of fairly vague idea at the outset of what it is they're trying to achieve, and then they only really sort of bring about the determinate construction of that goal as they're working on it. When you set out to write a novel, you don't have like every line of dialogue already sort of set out in your head and then just have to sort of put it on paper, because otherwise it would make novel writing much easier if that were the case. You would never end up with writer's block or deleting whole chapters and rewriting them, etc. It's only as you're actually working on this realization that you come to determine what the ideal that you were directed towards actually was. The idea here is that he wants us to get away from this idea that it's the future that is acting on us in the present as we're sort of working towards realizing, writing a novel or whatever it is. Because of course, you could be in the midst of writing your novel and then step outside and be hit by a bus and killed, and you never end up finishing your novel. So the future didn't actually contain the completed novel that realized your ideal. So if we want to understand this sort of realization of the ideal, we can't think of it as like a sort of passage of time from the present undetermined state to a future determined state. We have to think of the passage as operating in this sort of quasi space, an axiological space, from that undetermined state to the determined state in a non-temporal kind of development. And then the sort of empirically given development, in assuming that you are not hit by a bus and you do actually finish your novel, that development in time, from this vague sort of psychological presentation of like, here's what I want to write the novel about, to the concrete realization of the novel that is sitting on shelves in a bookstore, that development is kind of a projection of the sort of non-temporal, non-spatial development in this axiological, quasi-space, that this passage from the indeterminate to the determinate that exists only in this non-spatial space, if that phrase makes any sense. This example of the non-Euclidean geometry is even a little bit more interesting, because in this case, the sort of depiction that the mathematicians who were working on the parallel postulate, what they had, sort of what they were depicting to themselves, their sort of representation of this ideal, turned out to be illusory. And the ideal that they ended up realizing was quite different from what they thought they were working towards. So just to give like a very brief sort of historical overview of this. So you have Euclid sort of systematizing Greek mathematics in, I think, the 3rd century BC, 3rd or 4th century, I'm not sure. And he has these, these axioms and postulates. And they all seem, you know, fairly like obvious and simple. Like some of the postulates are, you know, to draw a line of any length, to draw a circle of any with any radius, etc. These are all sort of simple, basic operations that are sort of treated as given. But then there's this parallel postulate, which like the way you could present it is a little bit hard to understand, but like an equivalent formulation is that if you have a line and a point not on that line, then you can draw a second line through the point, which never meets the line, the first line, no matter how far you extend the two of them. And this is what we would describe as a parallel line. And this was like from the beginning seen as like much less obvious than and sort of straightforward as the other ones. And especially because Greek mathematics and philosophy in general was very hesitant about notions of infinity. So the idea that like, I mean, so whenever you draw a line, you of course are only ever drawing a finite line. But this postulate sort of presupposes that the lines would never meet no matter how far you draw them, but you can only ever draw a finite line. And so it's hard to see how you would be certain that the lines would not meet at some point if you drew it a little bit further. And so there were various attempts over the centuries to try to reduce this postulate to the other axioms and postulates. So rather than having it at the postulate that you would set out at the beginning of your work, you would instead prove it from the other axioms and postulates. And several of these attempts had the form of a reductio. So you would try to assume the opposite and derive a contradiction. But what ended up happening instead is that there was no contradiction, and it actually turned out to be possible to produce models in Euclidean space, like in the full set of axioms of a space in which the parallel postulate is not true. So for example, you can use the surface of a sphere. On this surface, you have you translate lines as great circles, so a circle that goes around the center of the sphere. And in this case, every line, so every great circle, is actually actually meets every other one at some point at two points, rather than never meeting any other, you know, parallel line. So if you think of like the longitude lines on the globe, for example, like they all meet at the north and south poles. So they're parallel to each other, but they meet at two points. And so you can produce a non-contradictory model of a space in which the parallel postulate does not hold within Euclidean geometry. So within a geometry in which it does hold. So if the non-Euclidean geometry, the one in which the parallel postulate does not hold, were contradictory, then that would mean the Euclidean geometry would itself be contradictory. And so this attempt to prove that the non-Euclidean geometry was contradictory actually ended up doing sort of the opposite, and proving that you can actually consistently hold that the parallel postulate is not true. And so the way that Rie is presenting here is that this sort of vaguely depicted ideal of, say, proving the parallel postulate on the basis of the other axioms and postulates. This is how the people who were first working on this understood what they were doing. Their work on trying to realize this ideal actually ended up realizing the very different ideal of non-Euclidean geometry. So in the case of the novel, you know, your novel might develop and change quite a bit from your sort of initial vague sort of understanding of what you were trying to do toward, and then, you know, as you progress, it might become something quite different. But you're still sort of staying in the same domain of like writing a novel. But it's, you could like this sort of deceptive presentation of the ideal that you end up actually realizing. You can imagine if it's like you set out to write a novel and you instead produce like a mathematical proof, like sort of by accident. you can sort of imagine that kind of development here. That, you know, you thought you were writing a novel all along, but then at the end you realize you've actually, you know, proved a mathematical theorem. So yeah, like what you think you are directed towards, what you sort of present to yourself as, you know, this is my goal, is not necessarily what it is that your actions are actually directed towards. So we shouldn't just assume that we have this sort of transparent access or this immediate access to what our goals are or what it is that are, what ideals our actions are directed towards. We might be actually realizing ideals without, while thinking that we're working towards very different ideals. Yeah, and so to build on Bat's comment in the chat here, this sort of highlights the fact that it's not the future as such that is sort of acting on the present. So the future, you know, so if you sort of depict, if you're thinking of like, say, the mathematical landscape as of, I don't know, 1500 or whatever, you have these mathematicians who are sort of depicting to themselves, I'm going to prove the power law postulate on the basis of the other axioms and postulates. But the future that ends up actually being realized is not that at all. It's actually, you know, the development of non-Euclidean geometry. In a sense, you can say that this ideal of non-Euclidean geometry is what they were oriented towards and what was actually acting on their, you know, behavioral field and so on. But this is completely sort of distinct from what was actually sort of present at that moment in 1500 was this sort of vague depiction of proving the parallel postulate. So the psychologically present, you know, vague representation of the ideal that was actually active at that time, you know, on the behavior of these mathematicians is quite distinct from the ideal that actually ends up being realized, you know, centuries later. So we have to sort of keep the two separate in our sort of understanding of what's going on here. That, you know, the psychological depiction of the ideal, our sort of presentation of what it is we're working towards, is not the same thing as the ideal that ends up being realized. Or maybe sometimes it is. Sometimes it might be. Like if you know, achieve your goal and everything worked out exactly as you thought it would, maybe that is an instance where they coincide, but that's not like sort of the general case. It's not always the case. And I think probably most instances, even if you do something successfully, you're going to find that like the means you had to adopt to achieve that goal were probably not exactly the ones that you had, you know, sort of depicted to yourself or imagined you would be using. Like, I don't know, even something sort of fairly banal, like in, you know, completing a university degree, for example, you're not going to sort of, it's probably not going to, you know, play out exactly the way that you thought it would. Maybe you end up having to drop a class and take an extra semester, whatever, you know, things happen over the course of that realization that are not exactly what you had in mind. So like in general, the realization is not going to be exactly what it is that you had imagined at the outset.
Yeah, I really like this idea of these, in a sense, non-representable ideals, which are gradually, but maybe not ever completely actualized. Or as you mentioned, if they are, they are actualized by means that maybe couldn't have been foreseen. The reference to symbolic representation on page 69, bottom of page 69, is also interesting in light of Kant and the idea of supersensible moral ideas, which have to be symbolically represented. And I haven't read the Third Critique for a long time, but at least as I remember it, the moral ideas are, you know, ideas with a capital I and Kant's sense, and in principle can never be directly represented in a way that seems somewhat similar to what Rouillet is talking about here. We've mentioned a couple of times in previous sessions whether for Rouillet the end goal needs to be representable or possible in advance. Talked about Bergson and the idea that, I can't remember which play he mentions, I think it's Macbeth, but the idea that Macbeth only became possible retroactively. Rouillet seems to be on, to have a position which is similar to Bergson's in this section, because in the example of Watteau, it doesn't, you know, if Watteau had died before the painting was completed, it does seem like the completed painting would be sort of real, but kind of virtual within all of the sketches. And, you know, not itself something representable without its completion by Watteau or I suppose somebody else.
Yeah, actually that passage that you pointed towards, there's a good, like just a couple of lines before that, there's a good sort of, I guess, slogan formulation of what Rie is talking about here. So he says, it is not the presentiment of the goal, it is the goal of which there is a presentiment which attracts the artist. So the presentiment of the goal is like a sort of a psychological state that is, you know, actually present now. So I, you know, sitting down to write my novel, have some sort of vague idea of, you know, this is a novel I want to write. But it's not this vague idea. Like my novel that I want to write is not a vague idea. It's an actual novel, right? It's a, you know, fully realized novel that, you know, someone else can read. And it's that fully realized novel that is what is sort of directing my novel writing behavior, rather than this, you know, vague presentiment of a novel, which is what is sort of present now. And then like he sort of puts it later on, like just the next couple lines, says it is not the presentiment, right. So here, yeah, this bit is the one I wanted to read. So if we want to respect the principle of concreteness by representing only the presentiment, it is no longer dynamic. If we want to respect the dynamism, it is necessary to abandon the principle of concreteness by representing the goal outside the field of the actual. So yeah, like this vague idea of, you know, the future possible novel, if you just have like this idea as such, this sort of vague depiction of the novel that you have in your mind is not in itself dynamic in any way. It's just a sort of psychological state. You can sit there and sort of picture to yourself this, you know, vague idea of a novel, but that doesn't in itself actually get you anywhere closer to writing the novel. But then on the other hand, if you want to have this sort of dynamic nature of the, you know, novel writing ideal, like if you want to sort of have this realized novel have this dynamic value of attraction, of like drawing the person towards completing the novel, then the ideal, you know, completed novel can't be something that is actually present in the person's mind or anywhere else for that matter. Because it's only once the novel is actually written that there's any like present, you know, actually existing novel. So like there's a kind of disjunction between what this presentiment or this vague, you know, depiction that you have at the outset, and then the realization that happens at the end. And then it's only as a result of this non-spatial ideal that you can have this sort of dynamic that links the two. You have to sort of ascend out of the realm of the spatial temporal into this axiological space to even make sense of the fact that you are directed towards completing the novel and you know, making it something that actually exists at all.
I wonder if so I'm thinking about like the difference between Rouillet and cybernetic and cybernetic influenced theories, which ground a lot of behavior in homeostasis. It seems like one of the differences between Rouillet and these theories is this idea that we're talking about, that the end goal, in at least some cases, for instance, scientific invention or a work of art, is not representable. So it's, you know, it's not representable from the outset, at least. So there is this, like, I don't know, maybe you could describe it as kind of seeking a kind of equilibrium, but the equilibrium state, in a sense, doesn't really exist until, or like maybe isn't possible in a sense until it has been realized.
Yeah, he does use the term in a few places, the axiological feedback. So it's like, it's almost like a translation into the sort of plane of axiological space, or this like different dimension of axiological space, of the kinds of, you know, seeking an equilibrium type of dynamics that that the cyberneticians and the Gestalt psychologists are describing. So he's saying essentially, yes, there is this kind of like seeking an equilibrium, only it's not happening in space or even in this, you know, behavioral field. It's happening in axiological space or in the sort of transition, the schematism between axiological space and real space. So yeah, it's a kind of like, I want to say it's a transubstantiation of cybernetics. It's like turning cybernetics into something non-spatial, non-physical, but I don't know, maybe that's a blasphemous way of describing it. But on this notion of like the sort of disjunction between the initial sort of presentiment of the goal and the ideal that you end up actually realizing, I think it was, maybe Angus, you would know this better than me, but there was like the new critic, you know, new criticism sort of movement in literary criticism that sort of denied that the artist's intention could be sort of the determining sort of principle of interpretation of a work. And one of the sort of like arguments that they gave for this is that you can, of course, you can intend to write a great poem, you can, or write a great novel, whatever it is, but your actual, you know, realization of that intention more often than not will not actually be that great. And so like this intention to write a great poem obviously doesn't determine whether the poem you end up writing is great or not. You have to look at the poem itself to determine that. And so likewise, you know, the intention to, you know, I don't know, write a play with a suspenseful plot or whatever, shouldn't be like taken to be sort of determining a determining principle for how we interpret the play, whether the plot is suspenseful or not, or, you know, whatever, or, you know, the artist might have an intention to use this character as a symbol for something, whatever, this religious principle, whatever it is, but whether that's a good interpretation or not is sort of independent of whether the artist actually sort of, you know, had that intention as a psychological sort of representation in their minds as they were writing. It could be the case that is a good interpretation of the work, but it could also be that the artist was actually sort of misunderstanding what they were producing, that they just had this representation, you know, I'm writing a symbol of X, and the work that they realized is something quite different. Or, you know, maybe that's one interpretation. It's something quite different. And so I think this, you know, Huye's argument here sort of aligns with that understanding, where like what it is that you realize in some kind of, you know, production of a artistic work, or, you know, a scientific work or whatever it is. And probably this, I think he would, you know, extend this to even just sort of everyday actions as well, that like you might, like you can think of, I don't know, you're having a conversation with a friend and you want to say something reassuring or consoling or whatever, but you actually say, what you say ends up, you know, being hurtful in a way that you didn't sort of intend and understand. Like the fact that it has this effect is not something that you can eliminate just by virtue of your intention. Like, you know, you might apologize and say, oh, that wasn't what I meant or something. And that might be, your friend might accept that apology, but the sort of meaning or the like value of those words as, you know, insulting and hurtful is not sort of eliminated by the fact that you didn't intend for those words to be insulting and hurtful. So yeah, it's this kind of, I like the way you put it here in the chat here, that it's out of your hands, right? Like once, and this is something Hegel even talks about as well, that like once you act, once you sort of take something from this vague intention phase to something that actually exists in the world, it's out of your hands. You can't sort of, you're no longer in control of it in the way that you are, you know, of your sort of vague intention. I think there's something, you know, pretty scary about that a lot of the time, that, you know, you never know exactly what your action is going to produce, what kind of effect it's going to have on someone. But of course, that doesn't mean you can sort of abstain from acting, because even that is itself an action. You're sort of realizing a goal of, you know, not acting, right? We're kind of stuck in this position of bringing about effects in the world that we can't fully control. This is sort of our condition that we're stuck in, and we have to sort of navigate that realization of ideals that may not be the ones that we think they are.
Yeah, I like the reference to the new criticism and the idea that, you know, the authorial intent doesn't matter in interpreting the text, and makes me think that about in the context of this section in the book, it seems like the ideal that, like, Watteau, for instance, is pursuing in making all these sketches of this big painting is not something that's just sort of, you know, it obviously kind of distributes and affects the way his behavioral field appears to him. But it's not something that's, it doesn't seem like it's something that's in, like, Watteau's head for Rouillet. Like, it's a bit difficult for me to, you know, visualize where exactly the ideal is, but I wonder if, it kind of seems like there's, like, the ideal painting somehow is, like, objectively real in a kind of this, like, quasi space, or has a consistency in, like, axiological space, and is being schematized, as you put it, by Watteau, but is not, you know, he seems to be saying that even if Watteau had died, there would still be, for, like, observers of the sketches, some kind of access to, like, this real but not fully realized ideal.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, the question also that comes up here is, like, to what extent do we want to identify the product that actually ends up resulting from the process with the ideal that sort of guided that process? You know, of course, the process of writing a novel or making a painting, whatever it is, can be more or less successful. You can end up writing a novel that is not really that good. And maybe in that case, we'd want to say that you didn't quite realize the ideal that you had set out to write. So yeah, in this case of the painting, so you suppose the painter dies before the painting is realized, you know, the actual sort of final painting is produced. Can we, in that case, say that there sort of is this ideal realized painting sort of, I don't know, hovering over the unfinished sketches, or like, you know, behind the unfinished sketches? I think it's always possible that if the painter had lived, that they would have, you know, sort of botched the work and not actually realized that ideal. Even if the sketches or the, you know, preparatory versions all sort of pointed towards, you know, this, you know, masterpiece of a painting, you know, the actualization might never have actually fully, you know, lived up to what the sketches promised. So it seems like, yeah, there's still, in principle, this kind of disjunction between what actually does get realized and the ideal that it realizes, even if, you know, in the case of something successful, presumably those two would align relatively closely. Whereas in the case where the sort of artistic or whatever kind of, you know, ideal realization would turn out to not be successful. So it's kind of difficult to decide what how we want to sort of depict the situation, but it does seem like we have to keep the distinction, like, in principle, between the ideal that guides the realization on the one hand, and the actual outcome of that realization process on the other, even if in some cases that might coincide. And in principle, you could sort of depict a limit case, I guess, of, like, someone just perfectly realizing the ideal that, like, this is sort of like the perfect novel of this, you know, ideal form, or the perfect realization of this, you know, painting ideal, whatever it was. But, you know, of course, in the general case, the realization will be, you know, not 100% perfect, but might still be a very successful work in many respects, but, you know, maybe not exactly perfectly realizing the ideal that was guiding the realization process. Because, yeah, so maybe to expand on that a little bit, like, you could also, an alternate sort of picture would be that, you know, every action realizes some ideal, even if it wasn't the one that you, you know, thought you were realizing or wanted to realize. So like, if you end up writing a mediocre novel, you have sort of realized the ideal of, you know, writing a mediocre novel, even if you at the outset presumably didn't, you know, set out to write a mediocre novel. You could say in this case that, you know, there is no gap between the ideal guiding the realization and the outcome of that realization. It's just that the ideal that you actually that actually was guiding that process is not the one that you thought it was. You can sort of depict the situation in either way, either like this gap between the ideal and the outcome sort of remains in principle at the end of the process, or you could say that like maybe, you know, every process, every realization, you know, realizes an ideal, you know, even if it is not the one that you thought you were trying to realize. Okay, so we can go on to the next bit. So I think we have like one page up to the next section break. Someone else would like to read from there?
I can read again. We're at regardless, I think?
Yes, regardless of the angle.
Okay. Regardless of the angle chosen for its study, the problem of psychobiological action is unsolvable unless the hypergeometric dimension is taken into account. Let us take, for example, the idea of possibility. Quote, the fundamental constructs which we use in representing the situation must consist of concepts from which one can derive unambiguously certain events as quote-unquote possible, others as quote-unquote not possible. I'm not sure where this original quote is supposed to end.
Yeah, it looks like there's a mistake with the quotation mark.
Yeah. But the man who seeks an ideal does not always know whether or not it can be realized. If it is only a matter of taking a full glass on the table without knocking it over, in the visible absence of obstacles, it is as if the possibility is inscribed in the field of vision. When it comes down to it, this possibility is already transphysical, as it only defines itself by quote-unquote survey and quote-unquote knowledge. But ultimately, it is easily calculable. The success of the feedback is unambiguously predictable. But an inventor, by definition, can never clearly know in his quote-unquote life space whether what he's looking for is possible. The moment he perceives this possibility, his problem, by definition, is virtually solved. Possibility is not a simple concept. It has stages that correspond to different quote-unquote distances along the hypergeometric dimension. If the possibilities were included in the field, and if the dynamic situation was fully representable, the activity would stop as soon as the equilibrium position is reached. The quote-unquote actualists are indeed compelled to recognize that this consequence is contradicted by the facts, especially in the case of human beings. David Kretsch and Richard S. Kretschfield, while affirming with Levin, whom they claim to follow, that quote, there is a constant tendency for the psychological field to change in the direction of reduction of tension, unquote, are compelled to add that this, quote, does not imply that the achievement of a state of equilibrium is the goal of the individual's action, unquote. But it is difficult to see how this incontestable fact can be reconciled with their hypothesis. Kretsch and Kretschfield attempt two explanations, each very different. First is mechanist. While in simple physicochemical systems, the final state of equilibrium is the same as the initial state. For example, when the blood's pH has unbalanced due to intense activity, the respiration speeds up in order to return the pH to its initial level. In the psychological field, the final equilibrium is almost always indifferent to the initial equilibrium. Its history is not that of a single fluctuating system always returning to the same position. Quote, it is rather a history of changing equilibria in which the psychological field restructures continuously, unquote. This explanation is clearly insufficient. It does not answer the question, which is to know why the achievement of an equilibrium state is not the goal of an individual's activity. Assuming that the activity is controlled by a set of multiple interrelated feedback loops, like Ashby's homeostat, it would still be seeking successive equilibria. And it would not be its own fault, but that of the environment, milieu, if a final equilibrium were never found. The second explanation is very different. Kretsch and Kretschfield appeal to the person's progressive physical and psychological differentiation in his efforts to integrate increasingly complex states through a hierarchical and mobile system of values. The individual's quote-unquote level of aspiration is raised as he achieves his first goals. He, quote, continuously sets for himself new levels of accomplishment, his levels of aspiration, that are above those of his present achievements. This is absolutely true, but it amounts to the complete rejection of the initial actualist hypothesis. Kretsch and Crutchfield can't help but notice, quote, this phenomenon seems to contradict a simple theory that behavior tends toward equilibrium. Here it seems that an equilibrium is voluntarily abandoned and attention deliberately set up. The person seems to be pulling himself up by his bootstraps, unquote. Clearly, the sole conclusion possible here is to reject Levin's fallacious postulates and the bias of a spatiotemporal dynamism. Kind of in line with what we were talking about with the last couple of paragraphs, while it may be easy to understand something like deciding to pick up a full glass of water without knocking it over when the water is on the table in front of you in terms of representable goal states in the field of behavior, it's much more difficult to explain something like an invention where obviously if the final invention were sitting on the table in front of you and you just had to sort of reach out to pick it up, there would be, you know, there wouldn't in a meaningful sense be a process of invention at all. It seems like these two explanations by Kretsch and Crutchfield, the objection to the first one, which is the mechanistic explanation that psychic life doesn't return to the same equilibrium from which it starts, but seeks a new equilibrium. He says that, you know, this doesn't explain why a human being doesn't just sort of reach, a goal state and just kind of rest at that goal state for the rest of their lives. I mean, you know, it's kind of obvious why that wouldn't happen with respect to like hunger and thirst, but less obvious on the explanation he's criticizing here, why that wouldn't happen with respect to some, you know, personal goal that someone sets for themselves, like winning a swimming competition or completing a novel or, any other kind of long-term goal we can think of. People tend to, once they've achieved something, to, you know, move on and set a new goal for themselves. That is kind of it's in tension with the idea that, psychic life can be understood simply in terms of equilibria with change, which change from the sort of beginning state to the end state. It does seem like it would be very difficult to explain why, as many thinkers have noted, it's not as if people kind of get what they want and then rest satisfied for the rest of their lives, but kind of immediately move on to something else if the goal is seeking equilibrium.
Yeah, and Simondeau had made a similar objection to this sort of minimization of tensions type of explanation that, of course, if we suppose that minimizing tensions is the goal, then we should, like, the sort of Brave New World scenario or like the experience machine that like philosophers talk about, this kind of scenario should be like our sort of ideal, that like you would just be hooked up to some device that would produce like pleasant sensations at all times, and that would just sort of minimize your tension. But most of us, I think, would consider that kind of a horrifying scenario as opposed to an ideal. This depiction of minimization of tension seems to be pretty antithetical to what we would think of as like a good life or an ideal, sort of trajectory for our life. And we instead, I think most people, people vary in terms of like their, degrees of ambition and what kinds of things they're, interested in achieving, but I think most people, you know, set themselves goals of some kind, even if they seem, you know, sort of trivial ones, but like, yeah, it could be winning the swimming competition or whatever, but you don't just sort of like, okay, now I've won the swimming competition, so now I don't need to do anything anymore. I've just sort of achieved my one goal and you know, that's it. You know, usually if you do win the swimming competition, then you maybe try to, you know, you sign up for like the national swimming competition or whatever the next level is, and you try to, you know, win that one. You know, you sort of set yourself more more challenging and more ambitious goals and try to achieve those goals. Or, you know, maybe you decide swimming, you've solved swimming and you're going to become a chess champion instead. I don't know, whatever, like you set yourself a different goal that, you know, gives you a new challenge. Yeah, so like most of us, you know, even if we are not doing things like writing the next great novel, we're still sort of setting goals for ourselves that involve some kind of challenge that we may not actually end up, you know, being able to achieve. And I think most of us would probably not necessarily want to be able to achieve everything that we set out to do. Like if every single action you took ended up being successful, I think most of us would consider that like as a sign that you probably have not set yourself sufficiently challenging goals to try to, you know, push yourself to achieve something worthwhile. But yeah, so this is kind of like in general just a sort of reason to think that this tension minimization is probably not sufficient to account for the fact that we, you know, give ourselves these challenges and, you know, set ourselves goals that we are not necessarily able to achieve. So we can, I think we can stop here for today since we're coming up to the end of the session. So we'll pick up from page 72. Thanks everyone for contributions, and yeah, hope to see you next week.